maintainer of Get It from currently. That's like a Brazilian guy, I think. We may see that or not.
Did you get this from the web someplace?
This is on SlideShare, and the account is Chacon there, and then let's see if we go up a level.
How do you spell that?
C-H-A-C-O-N. And so it's like Getting Get, I think, is the one that we're looking at here.
Are you going to make, during the presentation, you're going to be making argument where they differ from other?
Somewhat, yeah.
Okay, good.
All right, this is who is Scott, and that's, talk a little about that. He's got an account on GitHub, he works for GitHub. I've read this. I think it cost like $9 at a place called PeteCode. It's pretty good because Git has some concepts that are a little different than other source code control, and we'll talk about source code control a bit here. He's started a site called GitCasts, where he has screencasts about Git, which are pretty good. I haven't looked at too many of them, but he does a good job. That's important. He has a family. Okay, let's see. All right, what is Git? Git is, he calls it a directory content management system. It's basically a revision control system, and it's a distributed revision control system. Revision control means that you've got different versions of files of some sort, and you can go back and look at the changes you made on those files in the past. So it keeps a running history of all the changes you've made to these files. Now, throughout the history of Unix and Linux, we started with something I believe called SCCS, Source Code Control System, I believe. And we went to RCS, Revision Control System. The next one up the ladder was CVS, Content Versioning System. And then most people went from there a couple of years back. In fact, the CVS people started a project called Subversion, also SVN. Actually, that was pretty good. Except it's sort of a linear thing, so if you're one person working on a project, it works really well. If you're Linus and you've got your version of Linux and you've got 1,000 other people working on slightly different versions, it didn't work so well. So Linus actually came up with Git to solve that problem. Git is a tree history and a storage system for files. It's a stupid content tracker, which means it doesn't really look into the files very much. It'll do a diff on them, and that's about it, but it kind of stores blobs. It doesn't really have a good understanding of what's inside them. It's a toolkit. Originally, these were all the Git commands. It's a little hard to read with this projector. But there's like 140 different Git subcommands. And they're actually implemented as separate binaries. So if you call git space add, it'll actually call the git add binary. But you don't have to know too much of that. So the git system is broken into two parts. One they call the plumbing, which is the inner workings, and the other they call the porcelain, which is the pretty parts, the user accessible parts, you know, the ones that people usually use. So, you know, I guess the thing is, if you're using a toilet, usually just use the porcelain, but sometimes you got to go get involved in the plumbing. Hopefully you don't have to do that, or you have someone else to do that for you. So the porcelain, none of the commands you have to use yourself or need to know yourself is a pretty small subset. And the interesting thing to me is there's a lot of different ways to use Git. I think this might be what he was trying to get at when he said it's a toolkit. It's sort of a toolkit for building your own revision control processes. So the way I use Git as a single developer is probably a lot different than a small group of developers, which is a lot different than the way the Linux system works. And there'll be some pictures of that coming up here. Yeah?
You talked about Git just handling blobs and not really understanding files. Does that mean that it doesn't care what kind of file type you have?
It doesn't care. You can put images in there. They won't compress as well if you make changes to images. You know, they'll basically have to have both versions, and they won't be able to do a diff to store just the differences. If you do text files, anything text-based, it can compress them by just storing the differences.
The reason I ask is because I've used Subversion for some non-code things like documentation or DNS zone files, that kind of thing. Does Git better at that, worse at that?
I think it's a little bit better because it's smarter about knowing that they're not text files. You don't have to tell it. I think with Subversion, if you tell it, it's okay, but you generally want to tell it, hey, this is a binary file. Pretty sure that's the main difference. Git is not Subversion. It works quite a bit differently. Although there is actually a way to use Git Subversion on the back end and Git on the front end. So we'll talk about that a little bit more for Git Subversion. It's not an evolution, whereas Subversion was an evolution of CVS, sort of CVS done right. Git is sort of a whole new concept, and you have to kind of think differently to use it. Here's what I was talking about, RCS and CVS and Subversion and Git. But Git is not really the follow-on to Subversion, but it's most of the thought leaders now are using Git as opposed to CVS or Subversion or the Git competitors. All right. Here we show Delta Storage, which basically keeps track of changes to particular files. The other choice is directed asynchronous graph, which basically allows you to have more tree-like mechanisms of keeping track of things. And I'm not sure what these slides mean, so we'll keep going on here. All right. Here's how he breaks down the different types of source control things. We've got local, centralized, and distributed, and then we have Delta versus DAG. So RCS, CVS, Subversion, Darts, and Mercurial, and Perforce use Delta storage, whereas Git, Bazaar, and BitKeeper, and Time Machine, and CP-R, you know, just a recursive copy, use a DAG storage. And then we've also got, you know, the local, RCS was local, and then we moved to CVS and Subversion, where it was centralized. And distributed is pretty much the new, all the new things down here, Darts, Mercurial, Bazaar, and Git are newer things. And there's one or two others that have a little bit of mindshare. Bazaar has some good mindshare with, I believe, the Python people and Ubuntu is heavy into Bazaar. Mercurial seems like a decent product, open source project. I haven't seen a whole lot of mindshare behind it. Darts, I believe, is what the GNU project was going with. I don't know. A lot of people are using Git. A lot of projects are moving to Git. Of course, the Linux kernel. Ruby on Rails moved from Subversion to Git. I believe GNOME has moved to Git recently. And I think KDE has as well. So a lot of the leading open source projects are moving towards Git. All right. When you create... we're going to gloss over that. We'll see that a bit more. All right, basically, you've got this .git subdirectory within your working code, and it contains an object database of basically all your previous versions of all your files. And here he's going over pretty much the details of how we keep track of the files in this repository that keeps all this database of files that are currently in your working directory and that were previously in your working directory that you've committed. So it actually keeps an SSA digest, which is sort of just a way of creating a new unique key for every file and every version of the file. So if you change one byte in the file, it's going to have a lot different key. Let's see. Packing is the way to compress things by doing those diffs, so it saves a lot of space. But somehow I don't understand how, but Git gets away with using a lot less space than even Subversion, even though it seems to not compress them by default. So I've never really figured that out too much, but it's very efficient at pulling down a full repository. Unless it's in the gigabyte range, it's going to be pretty quick actually. So Git store has four different types of files, and you don't need to know this to use it to start out with, but the peep code documentation that I bought and read helped me figure this out, because it really does work a lot differently than the other things like Subversion. So you basically have blobs, trees, commits, and tags, and a blob is basically a file. A tree is a group of files. It's basically your directory hierarchy, and it contains blobs. It's just like a directory tree. And a commit is basically keeping track of the changes you made in a particular instance. A tag is just giving a special name to it. So if you have version 1.0, you give that the 1.0 tag that says this set of files is version 1.0, and then you get to 1.1, and it's another set of files that may contain some of the same files, but it's a new set of files that you've tagged with the 1.1 set. So the blobs include, one thing to know about Git is it doesn't care about directories, so the directories are not tracked. So you'd have a rake file and a readme and a Ruby file here. Those are blobs, but the lib and the current directory are not blobs. And the blobs, there's actually a file in the database that keeps track of the blob, its size, its location, and the actual content of the file. And so the header, and it looks like they're zlib deflate compressed by default. And then that blob has an ID, which is basically the SHA1 hash of this file contents plus the header, and then it gets a hash, which we'll be using. We'll be seeing more about that in a minute. So the tree basically keeps track of which blobs are in this current version of the repository. So we've got these trees. It really keeps track of the blobs that are inside it. It doesn't keep track of the directory name. Let's see. So as you see, this is a tree object. It has the size of the content. It keeps track of the content, but it doesn't actually have its own name listed anywhere in there. It does keep track of the names of the files that are within it, though. So it's a lot like a directory. A directory really doesn't know its own name either. And a commit is a tree that you've committed to the repository. You said, okay, I've made my changes now, save them, keep them for safekeeping for the future. If I want to undo that set of changes, or if I want to review them, and I'll put a comment on this set of changes. So a commit is a set of changes. But the way they're stored are not as changes. The way they're stored are as the current tree of files, of blobs. So a commit has the tree that it contains, the author's name, and a comment. So we'll see that in real life in a bit. So a commit contains trees. Trees contain blobs, and commits contain other commits, and trees contain other trees. And a tag basically is just a simple name for a commit. So simple. Once you've committed a tree or a blob or a commit or a tag, you can't undo them. So if you've got version one of a file and you change that file, version one of the file will stay in that repository and version two will be added. So you still have these two objects in your repository and you can access either one. Can't be moved. I'm going to blow through this stuff here.
Craig, can I interrupt you a minute?
Yeah.
I'm going to take two different situations. One is, let's say you're designing a web application, and let's say in another situation you're doing C programming. Starting, I guess, with C programming, will it track what libraries you're using and what dates, or do you have to do this separately?
It doesn't look at file dates at all. It looks at file content. So if you've got two blank files, they're actually the same object because they have the same SHA-1 hash. So it never looks at dates. It only looks at contents. And so, you know, it's a directed graph. So, you know, you can have a tree contains, you know, two different files, and each of those files are actually the same content, though.
It has to look at check-in dates, though, doesn't it? Isn't that how?
No.
No?
No, it doesn't.
So how does it keep track of what's the newer version?
It actually doesn't know what's newer, and that's the weird thing. And we'll talk about that a little later. It's anarchy, really. And he's got some graphs and diagrams that show this, but it's truly anarchy because it's really dumb. It just knows that, you know, I've got this tree called, you know, ABC123, and it's just a hex hash value, and I've got this other tree, and this is my current tree, and this is the parent of the current tree, and so it kind of look at its parents to see where it came from, but you can actually have multiple parents because you do merges, so it gets crazy, but
maybe
it doesn't.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but if I commit something and say, hey, you know, that's complete garbage and it breaks everything I've been trying to do and I want to back it out, how does it know what objects to back out?
You would look at the log file and find the name of that commit, the hex value of that commit, the hash of that commit, and you would say, I think it's get revert, and that commit. So, in that case, it would look at the parent commit, and look, it actually does a diff and undoes.
Is it up to you? Let's say you're using a particular kernel and you're doing kernel updates, which maybe you shouldn't be doing. But, I mean, is there some point where you have to document, you know, what libraries are?
As far as libraries, it depends if the libraries are in your repository. If they're in your directory hierarchy, they'll be included. But otherwise, they won't be. I mean, it's only files within your directory tree. So if there are files in your directory tree.
If it's pulling down header stuff and pulling it from somewhere else.
If it's pulling it from outside your directory tree, then no, it's not going to keep track of those. You'll have to use some other mechanism for that. And sort of like apt or yum, sort of, that's kind of what they do. And particular languages, like Ruby has something called Ruby Gems, which its job is interdependencies and library, pulling in libraries. But what Ruby does in this case is you've got these system gems, but you can also bundle them locally. And so you'll specify, hey, I want these gems, and it will pull them into your local copy.
So that you're always working with the same.
You're always working with something consistent. So when you're testing it, you can always run your own library versions that you know about instead of, you know, if they change them on the system, then...
You may screw everything up you're working.
All right, through a few of these. We've already got through about a quarter of the slides, so that's good. I do have some actually hands-on demos I've shown a little later. All right. The commit history. So, branch and merging. What happened to history? So see that later. So you've got branches, which... Like I said, these things get really anarchic. Head is basically your current version. Head is always your current version. but you can have multiple branches. So the default branch is master, but if I want to go work on something new, I might create a new branch that says, okay, I'm going to work on just a specific sub-project. And I'm going to make some changes, I'm going to try them out, but I don't want them to go into the main branch of this program. A good example here, I guess, is well, let's take a look at Firefox. Firefox does a really good job of creating branches. So the current version of Firefox is 3.5. And it's got 3.50 and 3.51 and 3.52. So if they have a bug fix, they would create a 3.53. But they also still maintain the 3.0 branch, and so it's on 3.012 down, so they'd have to come up with 3.013. So you've got these two separate sets of files, the 3.0 and the 3.5, and some of the changes that go in here also need to go in here. So you've got these branches that most of the new stuff is going to go in the 3.5 branch, but occasionally you want to take some of the changes there and put them in the 3.0 branch. And actually it's more complex than that because they've got a 3.6 branch, and people work on their own little branches to trust things out before they commit it to the 3.6 branch. So things get really complicated. Yeah.
But down in the plumbing, it's just saving the differences between the branches.
It's not even saving the differences. It's saving the actual files, each version of each file.
Oh, okay.
Which is doesn't seem as efficient, but I guess with the gzip deflate compression, it seems to work really well.
So if I go and create a new branch, like you mentioned, 351, 352, and 353, and I'm working on 353, and 90% of the file that I'm working on, or that I need for 353, aren't even changed for 351, is it just using like hard links, like rsync does, to save space?
It's its own database, so when we go back here, that commit, a tag is your tags and branches are sort of two independent things, but they all point to trees. And those trees point to blobs. So 90% of your blobs are going to be the same, and some of your trees are going to be the same because none of the files in that directory hierarchy have changed. But if one file in that hierarchy changes, then that tree changes. So basically, the changes kind of bubble up. I change one file, and that blob is a different blob. And then, so that means I have a new tree here, and then the parent trees. All right, you've got 351 and 352, two separate trees. But down here, when you get to the blobs, they're almost all the same blobs. You know, they're 90% of the same files. It's the same idea as the hard link, except it's just a database of pointers to hash.
So you've got multiple pointers pointing to the same
yeah.
object.
Yes, exactly.
Great.
Yeah.
Let's say you're working with PHP code or something.
Uh-huh.
Let's say you're constantly making changes and saving and then running to see how your changes are affecting your farm.
Right.
Can you do saves until you get what you want and then make a commit?
You specifically say commit these files. In fact, it's two separate things, which is different from subversion. We'll see this pretty soon. You say, hey, add these files. I want to commit these files. And then you can actually make changes and kind of back that out, and then you say commit, and you give it a comment, and it records your name and the date, and the comment, and all the current files that you've committed. So yes, you can explicitly say which files to save and when.
Because sometimes you don't want to make
it's a set. It's a set of changes or a set of files. That are the current version. So we'll see that, and I'll show how, I'm actually going to show my config files, how I keep track of changes to my config files. So, we'll take a look at that.
Thank you for downloading Firefox.
I didn't know there was a video for downloading Firefox. Let's see, let's click that a little bit. All right. So, Git has this concept of remotes, and it's a remote file isn't a remote repository isn't much different from your local copy, except that it has to access it over HTTP, HTTPS, SSH, and it has its own Git protocol, I think, but no one uses that a whole lot. Usually, you're gonna, if it's public, you're gonna pull it over HTTP, and if it's private or you're going to commit something, you're going to push it over SSH for the most part. Skip those. All right. So, like I said, normally you're going to have your local copy, and your coworkers are going to have their local copy, and then you're going to have your public copy. So, the user at the top there is pulling current version from this repository on the internet, and the person down here is pushing changes up to there. So, depending on who pushed first, you know, there's different versions, you know. He may get, if he pushed first and he pushed A, B, and C up there, he'll get A, B, and C. If he had pushed A, B, and A and B were up here in public, he'd only get A and B until, you know, until he commits version C up there. Yeah.
What's the difference between pull and fetch?
Fetch actually grabs the files, and pull does a fetch plus a merge, so it takes all the changed things and puts them in your current version.
Gotcha, thank you.
And advanced users say you should do those in two steps.
Right.
I'm not an advanced user, really. Merge. So I always almost always pull, but
yeah,
so most of the things I'm working on are just a single person project too. So
okay, so it doesn't have like a code war with somebody.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue is if the merges don't apply cleanly, it's better to have it in two steps.
Right, because you just have the. So does Git then hold the entire revision history?
Yes.
That's incredible. Okay.
Yes, yes, I think it is too. And it's really efficient at it. It's really, it's scary good, let's put it that way. So here it's talking, you know, these guys are both working on the same repository, and in general it works out unless you're kind of working on the same lines and the same files at the same time. One thing to know if you are working with someone else, on the same thing, before you do a push to commit your changes up to the public, you need to do a pull to make sure you're working with the latest version, the public version, so that you don't try to undo some changes that he's done. But it'll handle that. It'll tell you you did something stupid if you don't do that. And I have run into that once or twice.
Can you correct it? Backtrack?
Yeah, I've not had to figure out how to correct it too much. Usually it just complain and said you tried to do something stupid, but you can actually go in and take out commits. You know, you've got your tree of all these things that have been committed. You can actually take things out, and you can even take them out of the history, which is kind of scary. So I guess if you're a legal firm or something that you need chain of custody, it's probably not a good package to be using. Let's see what else we got. Good question, back there.
Yeah, you actually raised an interesting point. You talked about chain of custody, which maybe I think more in terms of patents. So if I'm trying to prove that, you know, this is an original invention, there's no prior art, and I'm going in and I'm mucking about with my history in Git, isn't that going to weaken any case that I have?
Technically, you could go hand modify a subversion repository too. So it's chain of custody isn't really a proof thing so much as requires someone to be looking at every point of it, I guess.
There's no point at which you can't account for what happened, I guess.
It does a good job of accounting for what happened, and it would be hard to inject something into it, I think. With, because you kind of have your current version here, and if you added something back there, it wouldn't really propagate. So that would be really hard to do. And it's why you don't usually muck with the internals there to take things out, but you do have the ability to, and you'd usually do that right on the end, right on the just the final versions. You wouldn't want to muck too far back because you might break things. Just because, you know, the trees are pointing to each other. So I think if you break things, if you try to mess with too far back in the past.
So if I'm worried about developing in a clean room environment, I don't need to be concerned that I'm using Git instead of something else.
I don't know. I would actually check with a lawyer and someone that really, really knows Git really well. And Subversion for that matter. That's something you don't want to mess up. Let's put it that way.
I actually had a conversation just before I came here with my neighbor who works for a reputable financial institution. I had mentioned CVS because I was looking to use it this week, and I put a comment out on Discuss, which came back to me, why would you want to use CVS? And then came a whole plethora full of alternatives.
CVS is pretty bad, I would say. Well, and one of the problems is that each file has revisions, and there's no concept of a group of changes to a group of files, which Subversion gives you that. You have version 1 of all my files, and version 2 of all my files, and version 3 of all my files. So from a legal standpoint, that's very straightforward. And it's at least easily understandable. Git is really hard to understand, to tell you the truth, on its inner workings on the...
My comment was, I'm going to see a presentation on Git to see if he was interested. He goes, we're switching over to CVS next week.
To CVS?
And I didn't...
From what?
I didn't ask for more. I didn't think of a hurry.
Yeah, and the thing I really hate about CVS is each file has a version, and you can't tell which version of file A corresponds to current version of file B, you know? That's what Subversion bought for most people.
So Subversion packages changes together in bundles.
Yes, it's a set of changes.
It's a bundle.
It's a diff of all the files in your repository, really, which works pretty well.
And if anyone's interested, I actually used to work in it. I am a little property law office. I actually have some expertise in it. While I'm not a lawyer, come see me afterwards. I'll tell you what I know.
Like my advice is always, there's someone in the audience that knows more about the topic than you. So, good to know. All right. I think I can skip these and cover them. Rebasing is a topic that's a little bit over my head, actually. All right. There's different ways to refer to your objects and object trees in Git, and I don't use them all, but we'll talk about them real quick here. So each tree and each blob has a full SHA-1 hash, which, you know, they run some mathematical algorithms on the file, come up with a number that's supposed to be, I don't want to say unique, but...
Right.
Unlikely to ever occur on any other file you're going to run into. Mathematically speaking, it's
really unlikely.
It's pretty random, but it's always the same for a given file contents. Let me show you here. I have one here. Here's a project I've been working on, and it's got, I made each of these yellow things starts a, that's, you can't really read that there. Let me see if I can track here. Each of the yellow things is a hash, and, you know, it's about, 64 characters long or somewhere around there. I really don't want to have to type that in if I don't have to, and yeah, I can do cut and paste in a lot of places. But you can actually use an abbreviated hash, and it's basically as many characters at the beginning of the hash as are unique. So if I'm in the Linux kernel, I'm probably going to have to use, you know, more like 10 characters. But if I'm in my own projects, I'm probably going to only have to use like 4 or 5 at the most. So you can basically abbreviate your hashes when you're referring to, and it's usually when you're referring to commits. And usually the main use case I have for that is when I want to undo, see, I made this fix here, and I'm like, I want to undo that. Actually, I usually look up in the cheat sheet, okay, how do I undo things? I figure that out, and I use my commit number there to say, git undo this particular set of changes. One highly recommended thing is to commit frequently so that your changes are small, so that if you are backing something out, you're backing out a small change that's not going to have overreaching and affecting a whole bunch of files. But you do want to have them atomic, so if you do commit something, you want it to be all the changes that were required to make the thing work. So you want to make them atomic, but as small as you can. Not too bad for 500 slides. You can always refer to things by the tags, which is kind of the whole point of tagging them, is that if you have a short name, you can remember it easily, like version 1.0. Master is a branch name. Origin here is a remote name, and you can name your remote repositories, and we'll see that in a bit. You can actually specify yesterday and 1 month ago. I've never done that. And you can say go back 5 revisions. You can go to parents, and these are a bit over my head as well. On, you know, what's a parent and what's a previous revision, and generation. So I don't ever use any of these really. You can do a range of things between two commits, so it'll actually determine the changes between a set of commits. That's actually helpful. Never use that one. All right, so this is actually kind of what the trees are conceptually. You know, I've got all these hashes of pointers to each other. So if you really want to get into this, check out this presentation online.
Is Git using MySQL or something for it to track all this, or is it all written?
It's all written from scratch and really low level. It's really low level plumbing.
All right.
One thing to remember. Do you have a question?
You see the Git C code, or is it Python?
Originally, I believe, and I had this discussion just today, yesterday. I believe the plumbing is in C and always has been, and I believe the porcelain used to be in Perl and is now in C. That's my understanding, but I'm not 100% sure of that. All right, there's three things you need to keep in mind when you're working with Git. You've got the working directory, which is basically you're making changes on the file system. You've got the repository, which is where you've stored all the changes you want to keep, you know, keep the changes, keep track of. So your working directory, you're not keeping track of it until you say commit. And at that point, it goes in the repository, and it's tracked. The index is a list of things that you are going to be committing to the repository. It's basically a cache of the files that you want to send to the repository when you say commit. To add things to the index, you use the git add command, and to take them from the index to the repository, you use the git commit command. And that's what I talk about. It's two separate. Most of the things have commit basically takes things from a working directory to the repository. There's this intermediate step with git, which once you get used to, actually comes in handy a little bit. Here he's got some examples. Probably best to show you real live use. Status we'll be using a lot, and then we do a commit. Okay. I told you these slides would fly through. All right, how do I use git? And all right, there's 152 commands. I don't think anyone's going to remember all of those. So there's 43 porcelain, the ones that you'll actually use. And actually, he's going to run us through each set of these commands, and I've used, he'll cover half, and I probably have only used half of this half. So I've probably used 20 of these commands total. Git.or.cz is where it used to be, the canonical download site. Now it's actually git-scm.org, I think. You can do the typical thing. Normally, Linux people are going to use yum or apt-get install. One thing to keep in mind is git-core is the package name. If you do just git, you get some weird font thing, I think, or something you're not going to like. For the BSD type people, there's port install git core. I'm not really sure what the plus the version is there. When I'm getting people started using Git, I have them configure some global settings so that their username and email address are correct, so that they automatically go into the log files, so that the author of mine is appropriate. So that's the first thing you should do when you start using Git. And these actually go in your tilde.gitconfig file. You can actually set some system-wide things. So there's like /etc/gitconfig, and there's a per project .git/config. So let's take a look at what we have here. So we've got a /config here. This current project has, this is the config file. These were automatically configured when I initialized the project, so it has a repository format version and some other stuff I don't know about. When I pulled it from a remote site, it keeps track of what that remote site is called Origin, which is kind of the default remote site when I do a push or pull. And it's stored at this URL, which is an SSH URL, and it tells it which branches to fetch there. Really understand that too much. So if I do my .gitconfig, so it's got my information. And then some of my preferences. So I have a preference for basically automatically doing color output. And I create some aliases because I'm always doing status, so I abbreviate that as ST. By default, it does not abbreviate commands, I don't think. So I basically do my own there. I don't remember if I set those, if those came by default. You can also say the gitignore is like the svnignore file. It just and again, there's personal ones. So I'm on a Mac here. So I don't want to store any DS store files or directories, whichever they are, which is just garbage that macOS creates in the GUI part. And I don't want to store any star.tilde files because those are backups from Vim or whatever. On a project, basically IDE files that I don't want to save with the project. I've got a previous failures file, I don't know what that's for. This is for Ruby on Rails, and the db.schema.rb is a generated file, so I don't want to store that in my source code repository. It's best to generate that because two different computers may generate them in different order, and then they're competing and storing different stuff in there. Yeah, All right, here's a more complete git ignore file. I don't want to store any of my log files or my PID files or anything in the temp directory. It has a special syntax which bash 3 point something or bash 4 supports, where slash star star means one directory down or as many directories down as you can. It's basically a recursive star. And I don't want to keep any of my database files. Some of my documentation was generated. Don't store any .git files, public files, and skip some of the JavaScript generated stuff. So anything you don't want to store in the repository, you can put in your .git init, git ignore file. And actually, each subdirectory can have its own git ignore file. So one of the problems I talked about was that, git doesn't have, it doesn't actually store directories. So if you want to create a directory that's empty, the trick is to actually create a directory that only contains the .git ignore file, which can be empty. So that's a trick that people use to automatically create a directory when they pull a repository. Back to the presentation. All right. One down. All right. Getting the repository. So you can either create your own repository or you can grab one from the internet. So most of the time, if it's not your own project, you're going to grab it from the internet. So, and GitHub is a great site that contains a ton of people's repositories, public repositories. So here he's copying something from GitHub. It's his project, and it's called Ticket. It's a ticketing system that uses Git. So I told you this guy was in Git. So Git clone, basically we're copying that repository from the web to a local directory called Ticket. Git can use any of these protocols, except for rsync. Generally for push you'll use SSH, and for pull you'll use either Git or HTTP. Alrighty. So when he does this, he gets, and let's see how, let's go ahead and do that. Git clone. I think because it's me, I think I have to use HTTP. And it helps if I put the okay, there we go. So it's grabbing basically the different trees out of there. And so it's done now, and let's see what it's, what is that, in K, 624K?
Thank you.
Oh, I'm in that version right now. So 312K it looks like. So, that's not a very big file, or repository, but actually if I nor Git. So Git is storing 200K of that, and the other 111K is outside of the Git. So we've got, so we can look at the log of that particular repository.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a good set of changes in there.
Pretty robust log, too.
Yeah. There's actually log formats, I think.
history, is that? Raw looks like. Not much bigger in Raw there.
Well,
actually, Raw keeps track. It shows you every file we change too. That's neat.
With the hashes too?
Yeah. I thought there was a format somewhere.
Short is that?
Oh, pretty equals. Okay. So there's a shortened version there, and there's a, this one is actually really handy, the one line version.
Oh, wow.
So one thing to do when you do your commit comment is to make the first line important, the important stuff, and then kind of put details later down.
Can I tell you, my friend uses the Git protocol to actually update his website, and so he adds all these one-liners.
That's pretty cool.
As a code change.
All right, let's see what we're doing. Okay, so we've cloned it, we've shown how that, we've shown how to copy a repository. And I'll be okay on time. So it pulls down each object, each blob. So if you want to create your own project, basically create the directory, go into it, run git init, run git add dot, which basically says add all the files in the current directory.
Even if you're just starting.
And then it'll can create an empty repository.
Okay.
So that's fine. And git init creates your .git directory and the config files and stuff. We'll talk about add git a bit. And that's it. You know, usually you put that container there. Looks like he actually already had a readme file and two other files in there. All right, 5M. Normal workflow. I already talked about the git ignore files. Adding and committing. All right. Normally, when I'm working on a project, I get in sort of this flow where I'll edit things, and then I'll see what's been modified by running the git status command. And I run this so much, that's why I put an abbreviation in it for myself. Some people actually put, an abbreviation, an alias, and so they call it GS. That's how frequently they use it. So here it's showing that he's modified the README file and the DD file. And if you ran git commit right now, it wouldn't commit anything. So if I just want to commit the changes to the README file, I can add that. And it says, okay, you've modified the README file. And if you hit git commit right now, it's in green, so it'll get committed to the repository. So I could do git add readme, and I could make some more changes to the to-do file, and I could commit that. Actually, I could even make changes to the readme file, and would say, all right, I've got one version of the readme file in the index, which is not the same as in the repository, and it's not the same as in your working directory. So it would actually commit that version that you've kind of gone on and changed already. Not recommended to do. Usually if you modify something, you want to have the latest version in your working copy going to that repository. But you don't have to. So there's two ways to add a comment. One is the dash M, and that's what I tend to usually do. But if you leave off the dash M, it will go into your preferred text editor, have you type in the comment, which is, if you're doing multi-line comments, you definitely want to do it that way.
So dash M in single quotes and whatever your
single quotes, unless of course you used an apostrophe, which you can't have single quotes inside of single quotes unless you. I usually use single quotes, and if I have a single quote inside, I'll change it to double quotes, and if it's more complex than that, I'll let my text editor come up. Yeah. Having used Linux and the Bash shell and other programming languages that have single quotes and double quotes that work the same way, I default to single quotes unless I know that I have like a string that I want to be converted, like dollar in or whatever, that I want to be interpolated. So that's also easier to type. So what happened here was he checked out his file, or he looked at his status, and he had already added the README, but he hadn't added the to-do. And then he ran the commit, and so the README file has been committed. Oops. And the to-do file has still been modified and hasn't been committed yet. So again, the two-step process there. So if he looks at his git log, so his comment is that he updated the README file. So in this case, what happened was that his changes to his README file and his changes to his to-do file were not really related, so there was no point in putting them into a single commit. Now, if you know his, what I tend to do is if I've made changes, then my to-do file probably is going to delete an item. So I usually commit my to-do file with any change. Here we've already taken a look at the logs. It shows the dates and comments and the authors. I talked about that. Can do your own log file formats there if you want. All right, sit down. Git diff, and you can actually see the changes, and this is something Subversion people are definitely used to. So you basically say, all right, show me the differences between, I usually just do git diff, and it shows me all the changes between the committed versions and my working version. Let's go mess with this tick git program, right? So let's mess with this README file and installing and breaking. Right. And then usage for dummies. All right. So if I do a git diff here, it'll show me all the changes I've made to the entire repository, actually. So you can see, and this is why I like the color commands here. Also, you'll notice that it automatically pipes it to less one. So very nice. Automatic colorizing, automatic piping to less. And so it says there that I deleted a line that said installing, and I added a line called installing and breaking. And I deleted a line called usage, and I added a line called usage for dummies. So, you know, the combination of the line deleted and the line added is a change. Also, there's some differences between my text editor and his text editor. Looks like I added a... I either added or deleted a new line to the end of the file. I think I added. So that's the differences between the working copy and the repository, the last head repository version.
Does it tell you what line? Or it did.
Yeah, it's got what lines in there. What file is up there, A, README, and B, README. It even tells you the versions. So I'm actually looking at the which versions are in there. So I do git status, and it'll tell me I've modified the README file. So let's git add README. And if I do git status, it'll show that it's ready to be committed. It's been modified, but ready to be committed. Here, I can also, the other command for diff is cached. The very latest versions will let you use the a different term, which is, what is it called? Index, I believe. Because they refer to that as the index, that middle step. So if I do a git diff, it won't show me anything because it's just showing me things that are not in my index and not in my working repository. So in this case, things that I've already put into my to be committed list is the cached changes. And then I would do the git commit.
What if you wanted to back that?
We'll have to get to that point in the presentation because I don't remember off the top of my head. It's one of those things I don't use enough. But we'll go do that when we get to that point in the presentation. So now I do git status, and there's nothing changed because I've already committed it. If I do git log, it'll show my name, date, my comment, and and maybe the hex value for my commit. Now, this is my personal copy of this repository, so it doesn't affect the one on GitHub or on anyone else's computer unless I would have rights to push it up to his version of the repository. So let's pick this back up. You can specify different branches and different revisions to do git diffs on. I don't think I've rarely done that. These diffs are usable by the patch command as input to the patch command, so you can actually send them to people. You can use git apply to apply them to your current repository. You can send the patches out in a special format. I've not used that. You can actually send them out as an email. And I don't remember what AM does. If I just do a, I can't do a git subcommand, it'll just tell me the, show me the man page for git. So what you do is you put a dash in it, and that'll tell you about the git subcommand. So let's apply a series of patches from a mailbox. Like I said, never used that one before. Patching rails. Skip that. Branching, merging, and rebasing. So we talked about branches before in the example with Firefox. So in that case, you've got your master branch and your development branches. Another thing that's recommended, and I haven't really gotten in the habit of this, but I'd like to, is a topic branch, where if I'm working on, usually I've got a ticket system, change number one is, hey, we need this feature, feature number one or bug number one, your bug database. Okay, I'm going to go work on bug number 14. Well, what you should really do is create a new branch called, bug 14, go work on that, get it working in that tiny little branch that only is changing things for bug 14, get it working there, and then merge it back in the development branch when you're done. That way, if you're working on bug 14 and your boss comes and says, hey, bug 15 is a priority, you need to get it done now, you can actually go back to the development branch, create a branch for bug 15, which doesn't have any of the changes on bug 14, as you can go finish bug 15, commit it to your development branch, and then go back and branch out back to bug 14.
If you're writing code that's accessing a database and you're creating a branch to make some fixes or some changes, in other words, create a separate database to run your test against?
It's all files. So what Ruby on Rails does is it actually has a separate database for test and for development, and you kind of don't mess with the production main one.
Well, that's where I was.
If they're file-based databases, then they're just treated like regular files, but that's usually not a good solution. SQLite is not bad, but I don't know if you want to store the database in the repository. That's one of the things we ignore.
That's what I was getting.
So you got to be careful with those, and Git is really not a solution to that problem. Honestly, there isn't a good solution to that.
Start developing.
Rails has something called migrations. But those even really aren't recommended for database changes on a production database. There's not a good solution I've seen to migrate schemas and migrate data on a database. Usually they're custom solutions.
So if I'm looking at your chart right, each one of the upgoing is a merging of the development branch back into the master, and at that point they're both the same until some more topic branches are merged back.
Exactly. Okay. And you can kind of do partial merges back too. You can commit, you can take some changes from development. You take just bug 15 and put it. I'd work on bug 15 and then put it back to development and then.
It's tested.
You might have a staging one and then a master. Master is kind of the main one. Depending on your conventions of your project, it may be the production, or you may have a separate one called production. You can have as many names, and it gets really, like I said, real anarchy, and we'll see that in a bit.
Craig, going back to my question, let's say you have a backup of a, let's say, a MySQL, a database. Is there a way in Git to have it that when you go in to make changes, that it will use that particular database? In other words, could you have an include file or something in a, you understand what I'm trying to ask?
Not quite. Are you trying to get out to a particular version?
I'm trying to say that you take your code that's not in production, you're making changes, but you'll use an alternate database while you're making those changes. I'm trying to think, if there's a way.
Well, the Rails way has you specify when you run Rails, I'm in production, or I'm in staging, or I'm in development. And
right.
And that's really the only way I know that works.
I'm just trying to figure out.
Git's not going to help you with that at all. Here, like I said, you can have production on your master in a separate branch called trunk. It's all about convention now. That is the word. Branching workflow. Here's why you might want to create a branch. You want to try an idea or you have to do a hotfix. Talk about those pretty much. If you do git branch, it shows you the branches and tells you which branch you're currently working in. This is showing sort of the history of that branch. Not something you can use every day. If you want to create a new branch, you do a checkout-b. So basically, you're creating a branch and you're making that branch your current working directory.
The branch's idea.
Right. So this is, like I said, I really need to do this more so that I create a branch for each idea.
Would you put an additional switch in to get it, tell why you're creating a branch?
No, I don't think you can do that. I don't think branches have comments. I think only commits have comments. A convention that's used is starting with the bug ticket number. That's a really good convention. And then putting dash or underscore and then a short description. That's a really good convention I've seen. So he basically creates a branch. He edits a file. He commits it. And when I said that adding and committing are two steps, you can actually use the dash A option to commit. And it will add all the files that you've changed for you. But it won't add any new files. That's a slightly bizarre thing. So he made a change, and he committed that change, and now he's got to do a hotfix. And so he went back to master. He edited that. He didn't create a branch for this hotfix. He just went in and worked on master. Made another change. Tagged it as version 1.3. And so, it's kind of hard to keep track of what's going on here because change 6 has been applied to master, even though change 5 hasn't been, none of these other changes have been applied to master, but he went and made change 6 and it's been applied to master. So you've got all these balls in the air, all these changes, and it's really hard to keep track of. And that's kind of what Git is doing for you in a sense, but it's really easy to get lost. All right, here he's changing to the development branch, and he's merging that idea sub-branch back into the development branch. And in this case, it applied cleanly, so he didn't have to worry about anything. So now he's taking the master and pulling in the development branch. So he's got just by convention, he's got a branch for each change, each bug number, I guess you would call it, and which goes into the development branch, and then he has to do a separate merge back into the master branch. If you got a big project, that's probably a good idea. like I said, I don't even do any branches for a single person project. If you've got a small project, you probably want to have at least development or single item branches. So here are the diagram. All right, we had already committed that hotfix version 6, and we had this development branch, and so it grabbed these changes here, and so C7 includes 6, 3, 4, and 5. And fortunately, 3, 4, and 5 and 6 were independent, so they didn't conflict with each other. I think we may see rebasing. I don't actually understand, except that it kind of put development and master kind of back together, as if development had never existed, I guess. And so it kind of flattened those two branches into one. In some ways, this is a controversial thing. Like, if you've already committed your tree out to the public, you don't ever want to rebase. You want to rebase right before that, because those people had a C7, and now they can't find C7, and their asynchronous graph has become disconnected. So I don't do rebasing, but I'm not very good at the whole branching thing in the first place. So slightly advanced topic. So I'm going to skip all that again. All right, sharing your stuff.
Okay, whoa. With all those changes, though, none of those changes have any conflicts, correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to cover conflicts or not. If you get a merge conflict, it'll basically tell you, hey, I couldn't merge all this stuff together for you, so I created these a special file. It has I don't remember what the extension is. Basically, you have to manually go figure out. It shows you version 1, it shows you version 2, mm-hmm. and you basically have to go delete the one that you didn't want.
Conflicts come in, let's say, if you got variables the same name or something like that, or?
It's if you had change over here in this branch and a change in this branch, and they were to the same lines of the file. And that's the main issue. If two changes, it could be you changing two separate branches, it could be two different people. If they change the same line and they didn't change them to the same thing, that's when you'll get a conflict. All right. We talked about remotes a bit. We talked about GitHub a bit, and I'll show you a little bit more of that. So a remote is basically a repository that you can access that's not on your current system, although actually you could use /// it can be done. So here he's adding a remote with the name called public, and it's accessible by this URL. And then he wants to push the changes to that repository, that remote repository. So he's saying, push my changes to the remote I call public up here, and push the master branch. And I think by default it pushes all branches. I'm not 100% sure of that. I know that the default is origin, so I'll add an origin, and then I can just do git push, and I don't have to specify public, and I don't have to specify master. And it sends it up there. You can see stuff about that. So he's actually committed all this stuff up there. All right. Fetch, I've already talked about this. Fetch is basically grabbing the changes from a remote repository. And so he grabbed the repository from GitHub. I created a new repository there, a new remote. And then he switched to the branch. And so pull is basically a fetch plus a merge. And we already talked about merge. And pull is basically just grabbing files off a server. And push is basically just copying files back up to a server. All right.
Do they, in any of the material you read on Git, tell you how to approach versioning and so forth? You know, like numbering. And I know there's...
Numbering of...
Yeah, well, you know, version numbering and so forth.
You mean tagging each...
Yeah.
Your, it's pretty much convention. I mean, there's no standard, although typically, you know, we use 1.0.x, you know.
And odds and evens and so forth.
Those are conventions that are followed by different projects and not followed by different projects. All right. Now, here's where things get interesting. We've got the central repository model, which is pretty much how Subversion works in the CVS, and all the developers are working from a shared repository, and they merge up to that, and they pull down from that. So they clone the shared repository, and they push back up, and here's where I was saying that this guy pushed, and this guy pushed, but he really needs to pull first, fetch and merge as a pull, and then he can push, so that he makes sure that he's not having any conflicts and not breaking that graph. Another model is the dictator and lieutenant, which is more what Linus does. So all the developers pull from this, the current version that's been published, and then they send their changes up. They don't have rights to send up to Linus's kernel. They send it up to Alan Cox or whoever else works under Linus, and then they go through the changes and send it up to Linus, and then he publishes it. So it's a cycle. So then they make their copies, they push them up to the lieutenant's repository, which they have rights to, or they email them the patches to them, or however they get them there. And then Linus pulls them from the lieutenant's, or the lieutenant's push them up to Linus's. And then he sends them to the main repository. So cycles through. Here's a model with one person that's kind of in charge of it. It's pretty similar to the last model. Let's see. And we're running low on time. And that we don't need to know about. Ruby has Git libraries. And where can I learn more? Gitcasts, pcode, Scott Chacon, and all right, we got through the slides. We have a few more minutes. What I've been working on is I work on quite a few different Linux systems and Unix systems, and I've got this notebook, which is a Mac. And so I would say that my config files have gotten out of hand, and they're not compatible across all systems at this moment. So I've been trying to. I created this directory called config files, and if I go back here to my home directory and list actually, you can't tell. But my bash RC is actually a hard link into config files. And config files. So my bash RC here is from Dwight. Let's do an I here. My bash RC here is inode 107.8.3.6.1, which is the same as my bash RC in my home directory. So I actually created a little script. Well, first I created a config files directory, and then I had to worry about publishing all my information publicly, so I broke it into a public and a private. So I've got a little script here, install.sh, which basically does the hard edit here. From my files here.
So say again, it does the what? Does the hard link?
It creates hard links that link my .config files into my config files directory.
Okay.
So my bash RC file in the config files directory gets put into my bash RC that actually gets used. And I've only done a few things here in this version, and I just today committed it up to github.com/booch/config files. And you guys are free to pull from this repository. And you can actually, GitHub is really cool because you can actually browse the files, look inside of them. And so what I'm going to do here is I want to add a line to this file, my ACRC file. And I want to create a file type add. So my normal flow is, okay, what changed? Okay, my ACRC file changed, so I want to add that. And then I see what's changed and what's going to be committed. So I'll do a git commit, M, and then add Haml type to ACK. All right. Oops. There's two different types of quotes.
8 minute warning.
Alrighty, so it committed there. I can do my git log and it shows, I just added that. Status shows that I'm clean, and now I'm going to do a git push. And I had already cloned from my GitHub repository. And if I look at my config files repository on GitHub, it will show my last commit. I can actually click on the commit to see the changes that were made. It'll actually let you put comments on GitHub about the changes. And so I'm in the master branch up there, and so I can actually look at, you know, my ACRC file.
So this is really just a repository where people are
can browse your repository. Really cool, and they can branch
and other people's as well. I mean, you know, they're what they've committed. In other words, so you can see what you can do and how
you can go over here and say, I want to watch this repository. I want to download it. You can. It's got the URL to copy your own version. So let's say I go to my other server here, and I think I have a. Okay, I don't have a config files directory here. So what I'll do is. And actually even gives you a little copy to them. So I want to do a public clone there. So copy that to clipboard. And then I'll do a git. This is a different box. This is my Linux box. So git clone, paste that in.
So if you made changes and you don't like them, you can go back and it will change everything back the way it was?
Yeah, and unfortunately I don't have time to look up how to do that.
I'm just thinking, I run Fedora, and it's constantly screwing me.
Another idea, and these are my personal config files, but another thing to do is put your Etsy directory in
a repository. That's what I'm saying.
People are doing that.
And also possibly...
You don't want to post that on GitHub, though. You know,
No.
You can actually, if you pay for an account on GitHub, you can get private directories that no one else can see, or that you can share with just specified people.
Well, I'm just thinking it screws up my drivers once in a while. And it's like, well, can I safeguard myself from them screwing up my drivers?
So in this case, you know, I've got a Linux system here, and I've got work systems that run Linux and different versions of Linux, and I've got a Mac. And this is going to help me keep one set of bash RC files and bash alias files. And, you know, if we look in here, I've got, you know, a bunch of bash things and some gem things and input RC and a Vim RC. I tried using Vim a little recently.
5 minutes.
And so basically what I can do now is I can make those changes on any of those computers, commit them to that local repository, and then push them up to GitHub. And then on all my other computers, I can push them down. So I can.
Can you also put it out on a, you know, let's say you
a personal thing? Yeah, you can put them wherever you want, any type of a URL. I think it said except for rsync. I don't know if that's half working, not working at all, or what the deal with rsync is.
I was. We can talk.
Any other questions? I will be going to see Nick and Elaine, so if you guys are interested in talking, I'm interested in having some of the